It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A documentary film exploring the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and its place in a global pattern of rising anti-Semitism makes its Pittsburgh premiere Friday at the AMC Waterfront. The film is called Viral, Anti-Semitism in Four Mutations, and it's the work of Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Andrew Goldberg. He joins us from New York. Andrew, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be on with you.
Andrew, what brought you to this topic?
Well, shortly after the election, the presidential election 3 years ago, we started to see a number of incidents that were overtly anti-Semitic and were drawing a lot of eyeballs. There were a number of cemeteries where tombstones were defaced. Later on, there was a rally that was going to be held against a Jewish member in a place called Whitefish, Montana. And ultimately, this all led to the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where the people were chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And so what we saw was this kind of the voices of white nationalism were emerging mm-hmm. shortly after the election. They were getting louder. And one of their biggest drumbeats was anti-Jewish.
Right. Now, this is not your first film about the Jewish experience. Had you been planning to make a film chronicling anti-Semitism before the Tree of Life shooting? Did what happened in Pittsburgh make you feel like, I have to do this?
Well, so we had actually begun before Tree of Life happened, and we were producing our film, and we were looking at the statistics, which were just hitting record numbers. You started seeing statistics that there were record numbers of anti-Semitic acts of one form or another in countries around the world, including the United States. And then, in the middle of our production, Tree of Life happened. We ran out to Pittsburgh. We filmed for a day then. We've been back to Pittsburgh several times. We had hoped as filmmakers that we had seen the worst of it. And as we've produced this film, it seems to have only gotten continually bad.
What did you learn from speaking with Tree of Life Rabbi Jeffrey Myers and New Light Congregation Rabbi Jonathan Perlman?
I think one of the most eye-opening things, though, for me was, when Rabbi Myers said that we had thought we'd hit a golden age for Jews in this country. There's been such a great amount of success in the arts and in culture and people, Jewish people doing well here, despite centuries of persecution. And that once again, he's reminded that even here in the United States, the Jews are other and will always be other.
How did working with a local producer, Diana Robinson, help you tell the Tree of Life story?
Diana is a Pennsylvania native. She's got deep connections throughout the state. She's an outstanding journalist. However, there are times in journalism when things hit you home. And I know that Pittsburgh hit her harder than any of the other stories because this was her home. She has friends there. She knows people there. So I would say it was a great benefit to us. And I also applaud, her journalistic distance that she managed to maintain despite the emotional pain this caused her and others.
I'm Kevin Gavin, joined by filmmaker Andrew Goldberg. The title of your latest project premiering in Pittsburgh tomorrow is Viral, Anti-Semitism in Four Mutations. In your mind, how has anti-Semitism mutated?
One of the most powerful places, I think, is that the virus of anti-Semitism has now infected the internet. It has just flown through the internet so that now, communities of anti-Semites that, if there was an anti-Semite in Chicago, an anti-Semite in California, and an anti-Semite in Philadelphia, they didn't know each other. But now they do. They can get together. They can create an echo chamber online. And how do you stop that? How do you stop whole communities that are getting together, that are talking to each other, that are strategizing things together, that are creating the momentum that you get, the groupthink that you get when you put people together? How do you stop that on the internet? You can't make anti-Semitism illegal. It's just too vague and unclear for something like that. And right. So I think that a lot of the anti-Semitism that we see around the world, and I'll quickly say we see it on the right, we see it on the left, we see it coming from various ethnic communities. We see it coming from governments. A lot of that would not be as strong as it is without the internet and without the kind of sewage pipe that the internet has become for this kind of rhetoric. In fact, our film right now is listed on one of these hate sites.
Tragically, you could have chosen many recent instances of anti-Semitism to illustrate your point. How did you choose the three others in addition to Tree of Life?
Well, we chose what we thought are the most critical inflection points that are happening around the world. So anti-Semitism in the United States, what we chose was the far right. So neo-Nazis, people who identify with white nationalism. Then we went to the left. We did that in England, where people, the demonization of Israel, the criticism of Israel, has mutated, so to speak, into outright anti-Semitism against Jews. So you have Jewish parliamentarians being called names, insulting names with swear words, being threatened, being told that people want to kill them. This is coming from the highest levels of government. It's coming all over the Labour Party, which is on the left. Then we go to Hungary, where the government has created a gigantic anti-Semitic campaign against the billionaire philanthropist George Soros, saying that Soros is the reason that there are all sorts of ills in the country, not the least of which is that Soros wants to bring immigrants into the country. The Jews are blamed in France for being the ones who are inside the government, who have the, not necessarily the government, but the insiders with the power, and that the Muslims in France, who are generally who don't get the best treatment from the government, who are not given chances there, who are many of whom are not integrated, the Jews are blamed for those problems, and therefore the Jews are mistreated.
Pittsburgh is one of 11 cities that will stage special openings of the film on Friday. What reaction do you expect from people who see the film here, where Tree of Life took place?
Listen, there's no question that Pittsburgh has a very, very specific relationship with anti-Semitism that other cities don't have. Let's take any other city. So there's anti-Semitism in most places of some sort, but no one has really experienced what happened in Pittsburgh. So number one, you have a Jewish community that was hit much harder. And number two, you have a non-Jewish community that was hit as well because it hit them right at home and because the people are friends and community members and integrated. So I think that for Pittsburgh, this is a much more personal issue. We went to great, great pains to tell the Pittsburgh story, basically only with people from Pittsburgh. And I think that for some people, this will be a very positive experience because they will feel some sense of catharsis. I think for other people, it could be traumatizing to see this thing and to see these images and these stories retold. And we look into it and we explore it and we talk to survivors and other people there. And so I wouldn't venture to know the answer, but I know that it's a deeply personal story and I hope that it is well received. We certainly did our best.
Andrew Goldberg is the director of the new film Viral: Anti-Semitism in Four Mutations. It's a documentary that recounts the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018 as part of rising anti-Semitism around the world. You can catch it Friday at the AMC Waterfront, and it continues for another week. Andrew, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Did your mom ever yell at you for listening to satanic music? Did your dad ever threaten to kick you out of the house for wearing all black? Did you try to run away and live with Ozzy Osbourne? Well, it may have felt stressful and scary at the time, but as it turns out, living with the Prince of Darkness was actually kind of funny. The Osbournes debuted on MTV on this day in 2002, shining a light on the eccentricities of the first family of metal. Was it staged? Maybe. Was Ozzy stoned most of the time? Probably. Was it great fun to watch this crazy train derail in your living room? Absolutely. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Birds are about to lose a century's worth of protections under a proposed Trump administration rule. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Julie Grant. When the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was signed in 1918, birds were being hunted to extinction for sport and to supply hat makers with feathers. There was a public outcry. The act now protects over 1,000 species of birds from a host of threats. Say a company wants to build a radio tower in a certain spot.
But for some reason, the Fish and Wildlife Service might say, well, that might not be a good place because it's in the middle of a migratory corridor, or it's next to a very important wetland.
That's Brad Bortner, former chief of the Division of Migratory Bird Management with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who spent 3 decades enforcing the act. Bortner says the government has used legal power to force companies to reduce unintentional bird deaths, known as incidental take. But the Trump administration is proposing a rule change. Only intentional killing of birds would be prohibited.
There was an attempt during the Obama administration to develop regulations and a permitting program. Those permits would require companies to take some best management practices to avoid mortality.
And did that go into effect?
No, that approach was canceled when the Trump administration took over.
The Trump administration started this policy shift with an internal legal opinion issued in late 2017.
And took steps to issue guidance to agency personnel to stop investigating cases of incidental take mortality. There have been examples of oil spills and chemical spills. And since there aren't investigations, it's hard to tell how many birds are being affected.
Several states and conservation organizations have challenged the administration's approach in federal court. Bortner is one of 17 former directors and leaders from the Fish and Wildlife Service who wrote a letter to the administration opposing the change and also a brief to the court supporting the legal challenge to it.
The signatories to the letter and also to the amicus brief have served under, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations going back to 1972. We all have a lot of experience with administrations in both parties in various levels of the Department of Interior and Fish and Wildlife Service. And we all felt it was important to urge the administration not go back and change the legal opinion.
Now the administration's proposed rule change based on that legal opinion is open for public comment until March 19th.
In my opinion, it's rulemaking too late. They have a foregone conclusion. They're going to put it in place. Not very hopeful that they will take into consideration alternatives, you know, that are suggested by the public comment or develop a different approach.
Had you ever taken a public stance like this before?
I have never taken a stance like this before.
And this time you felt like it was important. Why?
The Migratory Bird Treaty Act, it's been a living, breathing, evolving conservation pillar of the efforts to conserve natural resources in North America. I felt like I had a unique understanding of it and that I wanted to share that with the judge and try to reverse course on what I believe is a misinterpretation of the treaty and will ultimately result in continued decline of America's natural resources.
That's Brad Bortner, former chief of the Division of Migratory Bird Management at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Julie Grant.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy celebrated last November when voters narrowly approved a property tax increase that would pump an estimated $10 million a year into parks improvement projects. But there have been several contentious conversations since then about how to spend the money and who will oversee the process. Oliver Morrison of PublicSource.org has been following its progress. He joins us now. Oliver, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
So there's a hearing about this issue tonight. City Council will be there. So will the Conservancy. The public can share their hopes, concerns, frustrations. But I want to go back a little bit. There's a bit of a back and forth among members of Council and Conservancy CEO Jane Miller. Here she is talking late last month.
I think they were attentive early on when I got here and we started the whole process and I would meet with them. But as we got to the place where we were developing the plan, I'm not sure that all council members really paid attention to what that was or were at meetings. It was also difficult for me to get some meetings with council members.
Oliver, what do council members say they don't like or they don't understand about it?
There's a bunch of things. I think one of the things that some council members are upset about is they feel like they were misled about whether there was going to be matching funds from the Conservancy. So part of the idea was that this tax referendum was going to raise some public money and the Conservancy was going to match it with their own private dollars. But when a meeting came up recently asked, has there been any money raised? The answer is no. And that's not how they're planning to do it, not up front, but with project by project.
The meeting started because council wants to start over. That's the purpose of the public hearing this evening. They're starting from scratch because they considered an earlier plan. Multiple schools of thought about how to split that money. Can you walk us through some of them?
Well, there's a couple major competing plans and then some back and forth. So one of the plans early on from Councilman Coghill was to just split the money equally among all districts. And this upset particularly Councilman Burgess, because the idea when this plan was being proposed was that there was going to be some equity built into this plan. So it wasn't just going to be split equally across the city geographically, but some of these underinvested neighborhoods would get it. So the Burgess came back and proposed his own plan, which was to start with what the Conservancy wanted, which had this equity built in, trying to invest in some of these under-resourced neighborhoods.
So Reverend Burgess wanted to say, where is the need greatest, rather than you get a million this year, you get a million, and so on down through the nine council districts.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's been a fight. Like, Councilman Coghill thinks he wants, like, he feels like he's not getting money for his people. He's here to represent his neighborhood and bring home the bacon. And Reverend Burgess is thinking, like, no, we need to look at this sort of like higher purpose, think about who really needs it and who's in need. Those are two maybe of the bigger poles, but there's some views in between.
What are some of those views, those nuances?
Well, so for example, Councilman Gross brought up the idea that, well, maybe there's not even enough equity built into this plan, because she's saying, like, the Parks Conservancy is so focused on the parks, they've forgotten about people that don't live near a park. And so there's about 10% of the city they found that doesn't live within 10-minute walk of the park. And she's saying, well, what are we doing about them? Are we hearing from them?
But there are 165 parks, I believe, in the city.
Yeah, that's true. But there's a limited amount of resources. So even though we're bringing in $10 million in extra resources every year, that's still not enough. And so they have to prioritize, not only because that's not enough, but because who gets that money first? It's 165 parks. Everybody wants it, some of that. And what order do we go in is one of the big questions.
What is Conservancy CEO Jane Miller's reaction as the steward for the city's 165 parks? Does she have a preference, equal distribution or more equitable response to greater needs?
Well, I think if you look at the plan, like part of this has just been a misunderstanding by council. I think that's what she's been frustrating for her. Her plan has always had equal distribution and equity built in. There's going to be most of the money is going to be distributed geographically and based on the parks that are just in bad shape and need it, that need more upkeep. But then there's a smaller portion, about a quarter of it, that's going to be that is going to go towards this equity. That's always been their plan. But I will say that you have to be careful when you're talking to these council members when you say she's the steward of the parks, because these councilors are very prickly about saying, no, this is public money. We're in charge. We decide we're going to be the ones that do it. On the other hand, some of the councilors think, like, hey, the Parks Conservancy spent like a year or more developing this plan, talking to residents, really getting a big picture of what the parks need. And we shouldn't just start from scratch. That shouldn't be the purpose, that we should really move forward with some of the ideas in their plan.
Did you get the impression from Jane Miller that council didn't even think they would have to be dealing with this issue about who's administering the fund? In other words, the ballot question might not even get approved.
Yeah, that has been explicitly said by many of them, that they didn't think it was going to get improved. And I think part of that is part of what she was talking about at the top, where they just didn't think about it very carefully because they didn't think it was going to pass. I think also because it passed so narrowly, a lot of them are kind of questioning whether or not there was a really robust debate, whether the people have really had a chance to weigh in and understand this plan. They've sort of denigrated the campaign, saying, yeah, it's a bunch of mailers, it's a bunch of maybe ads that are a little bit misleading, and has the public really had its chance to weigh in? That's why they kind of are feeling a little validated in their desire to really push this public debate forward right now.
We're talking about a public hearing, the public debate you're talking about. That public hearing is this evening to discuss how City Council will use the new tax money to support Pittsburgh parks. Oliver, council seems equally flummoxed about the expectations of matching funds that you alluded to. All last fall, CEO Miller said that if voters approved this tax hike, they'd match our tax dollars with money from foundations, other donors. Council thought she'd be fundraising by now. She says no. So where's the confusion about these matching funds?
I think everyone is still a little bit confused. I think one of the things you hear is that she says that they can raise this matching funds if they are awarded some of these contracts with the city. But it's a big ask. They've already been raising $8 million a year for their normal operations. And so if they were going to continue their regular operations and do these matching funds, that would more than double the amount they're supposed to fundraise. And that's a big ask. And I think until we know what the city plan looks like, it's going to be hard for the Conservancy to even start undertaking this effort. But the city itself, and so a lot of these councillors, are not convinced that the Conservancy is the one that should get all or even most of this money. They're going to have to fight for it.
Here's Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy CEO Jane Miller again talking about those disagreements about those funds.
I don't want to focus on the negativity or the challenges about doing that. I'm about figuring out how do we make this work in a way that delivers the best services and the best product of our parks to the residents of Pittsburgh. Because to me, that's what this really is about.
So, Oliver, briefly, what are you hearing there from Jane Miller?
I think that she recognizes that the city council is the one that is ultimately going to make the decisions. She believes that the Conservancy brings a lot of value. They're good at fundraising. They work in the parks. They bring a lot of skill. And I think they hope that they're going to be a big part of implementing this. But she recognizes that, you know, this is public money, public tax dollars, and ultimately, you know, they're the ones that are going to have to decide. So she's, you know, being deferential.
Okay, just a minute left. What will you be listening for from this evening's public hearing on how to use the tax revenue to rehab the parks?
I'm really curious who's going to turn out tonight. Like, is it going to be the parks people that are really excited and they bring out their people? Are the people in Anthony Coghill's district who are upset that they haven't had their parks, are they going to show up and complain? Are maybe some of these 10% of people who we haven't really heard from at all that don't live near a park, are they going to say, hey, like, why don't you start mowing the vacant lots in our neighborhood instead? Like, that, you know, it's going to be really fascinating. And I'm also curious if just the heated rhetoric we've seen from city council members is going to come out in residents as well.
Okay. And very briefly, any indication how long it'll take council to agree on a plan?
There's not a lot yet. They're supposed to be talking back room with the mayor, but it's not very clear yet.
Okay, and we'll look forward to your continued reporting on this issue. Oliver Morrison is a reporter for PublicSource.org. Thanks, Oliver.
Thanks so much.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out about Sarah Lee Guthrie.
When the morning's over and you gotta get up, how you gonna get along?
Born in 1979 into a prominent folk music family, she's the youngest daughter of folk singer Arlo Guthrie, and her grandfather is Woody Guthrie. While she was always surrounded by music, her interest in making it wasn't piqued until 1997 when she served as her father's tour manager. Soon after that, Guthrie met Johnny Irion, another musician with an historic family. His great-uncle was Grapes of Wrath author John Steinbeck. Guthrie and Irion married in 1999, and the pair have released six albums together.
She's got a pretty little kitty named Jeremy out.
To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Jazz trumpeter Byron Stripling joined the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra as its second ever principal conductor of its POPs program in January. For The Confluence, WESA's Bob Studebaker asked him what inspired him and how those influences may influence what we hear in the POPs programming later this year.
I infuse jazz in everything I do because I'm a jazz man, but I also have a love and appreciation for all types of music, including classical music. That's very important to me. It's part of my foundation and what I heard when I was growing up. Yeah. You know, my father, when I was coming up, we always heard the broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera that was usually on like a Sunday or Saturday. Classical music was prevalent, always hearing that. But to relax, my father would play jazz. And so I was hearing Miles Davis as a kid, Duke Ellington, he loved Dizzy Gillespie, all these great people. And then if he wanted to keep relaxing, then he'd put on the Temptations and the Four Tops and the Old Jays and all those things. Then he'd put on Aretha Franklin. And then if he wanted to relax some more, he'd go to Sinatra. And then he'd go to Paul Simon. And so our whole thing in our family was great music and great art. My parents took me to see the great Leontine Price, The Soprano, but they also took me to see Ella Fitzgerald, right? They took me to see all this great music. And so to answer your question, that's what the POPs program is going to look like. Okay. It's going to look like all this like diverse kind of music, and it's something there for everybody. And the other thing that I hope people will do is realize that you might not be a jazz person over on this thing, but after you trust me a little bit, you're going to come to that concert, whatever concert it is going to be. You might not be a folk guy. You might not be a pop person, but you're going to come to that concert because you realize there's always going to be something there that's high quality music. And that's really the whole thing. You've got the amazing musicians of the Pittsburgh Symphony, some of the greatest musicians in the world, who you put any piece of music in front of them and they tear it up.
Yeah.
I'm scared when I'm on the stage with those guys.
And they won a Grammy just this last year, too.
Well, excuse me. They won many Grammys, you know.
Grammys over the years.
You got to excuse me on that. Okay. No, yeah, they did. And I was telling people the other day, I got to hear some of those recordings. And just you hear those Grammy-winning recordings, and you just become imbued with like energy because they're so incredible. But, you know, we were just talking about the jazz thing. When I hear Shostakovich's Fifth, which is another Grammy for the Pittsburgh Symphony, I think jazz. When you hear the last movement, boom, boom, bam, sabadoo, beep, 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 see, I'm scatting it, you know. Beep, 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 bap. They put the bap in there. They play it like it's Count Basie's band, right? So they got some soul in there. So when you come to Pop's concert, it's the same thing. We're going to take that same soul, and we're going to shape it, and we're going to mold it, and we're going to sculpt it. And when people come in the theater, what you're going to do, they're going to pat their foot. It's going to feel good to them. Three words, always, in a Stripling concert. Pat your foot. Feel good. Come there. The theater's a magical place. You know, you come to the theater, you know what happens? Remember that song? Forget your troubles. Come on, get happy. Remember that one?
Yeah, sure.
That's what happens when you go into theater. That's the magic that I'm supposed to create. That's what music creates for you. So when you come into that theater, it feels good. You don't want to be watching TV all day, right? So you come to theater after you've heard all those news flashes and the Twittered, and you've been Facebook, and you've done all that stuff, and you come and you just feel good.
There's a real collegiality in the Pittsburgh jazz community. In fact, you'll find maybe 50 different jazz events happening in any given week in Pittsburgh.
No way.
It's a surprisingly thriving jazz community, pretty much centered around Roger Humphreys, who was the drummer on Horace Silver's Song for My Father.
Absolutely, Song for My Father,
Yeah. And Roger, after a number of years touring the world, he said, I want to come home and raise my kids and live a life of normalcy. And he has been here, and he has been the heart and soul of the jazz community ever since. But he's certainly not the end of the jazz community.
Of course.
A wide variety of musicians performing in a wide variety of places, and I look forward to catching you in different contexts.
Well, you guys are doing it. So when I'm back and we have a moment, take me somewhere and we'll sit in, you know?
That's exactly what
do. You play anything?
I can only play a CD player. That's all I can do. I can't carry a tune in.
Well, I can play along with CD players, so we'll do that next time, too. You put on the CD, I'll take out my horn, and we'll spabadoodle bop jwang de ga ba da loo bop jabing bop de ah ah.
Oh, man, that sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
Byron Stripling, thank you very much for coming in and spending some time with me, and welcome to Pittsburgh.
Can I come back?
Oh, man, by all means, come
back. All right,
back.
And we'll put on the CD. I'll play along with it, all right?
That sounds perfect. Thank you very much.
Ow!
All right.
That was Byron Stripling, the new director of the Pittsburgh Symphony Pops, talking with WESA's Bob Studebaker. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the new executive director of the Pittsburgh NAACP says she wants to make the organization forward-looking, proactive, and a force to be reckoned with. A conversation with Kelly Ware Sebron. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Caroline Perk. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.